Welcome to episode 5 of The Infectious Myth. I'm David Crowe, your host, and today I'm very pleased to have with me Dr. David Rasnick. David, are you on the phone?
I'm with you, Dave. Good to be with you.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, too. And today I'm really excited that we're going to be talking about aneuploidy and cancer. I've known you probably more through the issue of AIDS, and I think we might touch on that a couple of times. But you've worked with Dr. Peter Duisberg on what is the third heresy of Peter Duisberg. The first was related to cancerous oncogenes not actually causing cancer, that the mutation theory of cancer was wrong. The second was, of course, HIV and AIDS, and the third was aneuploidy. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, that's at least three. The aneuploidy and the gene mutation thing are, I guess you'd call it 1A and 1B, maybe.
Yeah, they're sort of the other sides of the coins. Now, a lot of people might not know what we mean by aneuploidy, so let's start with a little bit of basic human cell biology. So,
okay.
Humans,
you want me to do it, or you want to open?
Well, why don't I lead you through it, and you
okay.
Fill in the blanks for me. Okay, so humans have 23 chromosomes, right?
23 different chromosomes, right.
Right. Now, most cells in the human body are diploid, which means that they have a double set, right?
Right. 23 chromosomes come from the father, and the other 23 come from the mother to make the pairs of 23.
Right. So the chromosome pairs are very similar except for the X and Y, correct?
Right. The X is very long, contains many more genes than the tiny little Y chromosome.
Okay, and the pairs do differ in details, and that's why the germ cells of humans and other animals, plants, are not diploid. They don't have double set. They have a single set, right?
I didn't quite catch the question.
The germ cells of
the
and the egg,
right.
They only have a single set, right?
That's right. I mean, the egg and the sperm only have a total of 23 chromosomes, and when the sperm fertilizes the egg, then you have the 23 from the mother and the 23 from the father for a grand total of 46 chromosomes. In the non-gametes or non-reproductive cells.
Right, right. And so every time a cell in the human body, and this applies to pretty much all life, every time a cell divides, it has to divide all the chromosomes, and both cells that are produced will end up with identical sets of chromosomes after the process called mitosis, correct?
That's right. So you have 46 chromosomes in your cells, 23 pairs of chromosomes. During cell division, prior to cell division, those are doubled, giving you 92 chromosomes. And then during cell division, that 92 is split out such that each of the two daughter cells now has the original 46 chromosomes again, and that's normal. And you just keep getting 46, 46, 46, and 46 in normal cell division.
And this must be an extremely accurate process because, of course, if it went off the rails, as we'll talk about that later, bad things would happen. And this happens presumably millions of times a day in a normal human being.
Yeah. It's a remarkable scenario of precision and accuracy. Nothing competes with it in the man-made world, that's for sure.
Yeah, like if you were 99.99% accurate, it probably wouldn't be good enough.
It's not so crucial because we have so many cells and they regenerate themselves. If there's a problem and they don't divide properly, typically those cells are eliminated. They die out and you never even know you had them.
Okay, so that's sort of the check and balance on the process of mitosis.
Right.
But as we'll talk about later, that doesn't always happen. So there are sometimes when there aren't the right number of chromosomes, and you talked in some of your work about the condition known as Down's syndrome, and those people have an extra chromosome?
That's right. They have three copies of chromosome 21. The smallest chromosome only has a couple of hundred or so genes on it. People should, they may not understand about the chromosomes. The genes, the human genome, the 20-some-odd thousand genes that we humans have, are divided among the 23 different chromosomes. The chromosomes act as volumes. For example, like in Encyclopedia, we have all these different volumes. Well, the
right.
genes are divided into volumes called chromosomes. And the smallest chromosome is chromosome 21. And if there's three copies of chromosome 21, and if the fetus and the embryo don't die out, which almost always happens when there's three copies of 21,
mm-hmm.
but occasionally there will be a live birth, and then you'll have the Down syndrome child. And they have all
right.
kinds of metabolic problems, and they have increased risk of cancer and so on as a consequence of just having an extra copy of the smallest human chromosome.
Yes, yes, and like you say, that's only one extra chromosome, so that's about as small of a destabilization of the genome as you can get. And as you also pointed out, that it's normally fatal, but there are
right.
some humans that grow up and live with that extra chromosome.
But they don't live very long. You know, they don't live very long. Not like a full normal healthy life.
Yes. So the dominant theory of cancer today, and I'm sure everybody's familiar with that, is that mutations cause cancer. Or maybe it's more accurate to say that if something causes a mutation, like radiation or a chemical or something, that will cause cancer. So does that mean that there is, for example, for breast cancer, a mutation that will cause a certain type of breast cancer?
Well, that's the current thinking anyway. People have heard of BRCA, BRCA1, BRCA2,
right.
and a whole host of gene mutations. There are over 100 now that people have claimed are responsible for cancer, either directly causing cancer, the so-called oncogenes, or the tumor suppressor genes that protect you against the action of oncogenes. And when they get mutated, then that normal protection doesn't work. That's the current wisdom among that most cancer researchers, at least in the United States, probably in Europe too, are working under right now. And Peter and I and a growing number of people, even cancer researchers themselves, know they have a real serious problem with that scenario of cancer, and I'm convinced it's just plain wrong.
So what are some of the problems with the mutation theory of cancer?
Well, it has one of the biggest problems is if there are mutations that cause cancer, then there should not be an age distribution of cancer. There should be people born with cancer. You know, there are occasional ones in childhood leukemias and things like that. But we're talking about an exponential rise in cancer with age. That should not happen if gene mutations cause cancer, because you're born with mutations. There are actually more gene mutations in you and me, Dave, me or anybody else, any two people on the planet, than there are in a person's own cancer. There are more mutations in two normal people that distinguish them than there are between the person's normal genome and their cancer genome. So there should be virtually every kind of mutation that there is present in some cell in somebody's body somewhere, and you should have cancer all the time. You should be born with cancer,
right.
and that's clearly not the case.
So don't they say that, okay, well, maybe when you're 50, a cell gets mutated, a single nucleotide, I guess, gets mutated and starts a chain of events. Isn't that like something that could happen after birth?
Yeah, but the problem is there's two really big problems. If it was the so-called dominant oncogene, which a single mutation in that gene would lead to cancer, then everybody would have cancer all the time. Now, as soon as you start adding more gene mutations that are necessary for cancer, then almost virtually nobody would have cancer, because you have to have all the requisite mutations. They're saying up now 6 or 7 mutations. They all have to be in the exact same cell.
Right, I was going to say that.
If you're born and you get another one and so on and so forth, but you'll never, ever, we have cells in our body, you know, many trillions of cells. They're 10 to the 15th,
right.
I forget, 14, something like that, huge number of cells. And the chances that any one of those cells is going to have the right combination of gene mutations to generate cancer, there's not been enough people or alive on this planet or in the cosmos so far for cancer to develop. So the mathematically, the gene mutation thing just doesn't work.
Okay, so if they're now doing testing for genes, and we have the horrible spectacle of people like Angelina Jolie cutting off both her breasts because she had a positive test for a breast cancer gene, but those genes must have been inherited, because if a mutation occurred when you were 40, it would only be in one cell of your body. So in order to do a test, it has to be something that's present throughout your body, because they just randomly take a few cells, presumably, and analyze those. So I understand what you're saying. So that if Angelina Jolie was born with breast cancer genes, and what is she now, 45 or 50 or something, how come she didn't get cancer already, let alone the hypothesis that she's going to get it in the future, if she's been sitting with those genes all this time?
Well, that's the problem. First of all, that BRCA does not cause any cancer. None of these gene mutations, not one nor any combination of the so-called cancer genes, has ever been demonstrated to cause cancer. There's no evidence at all that these combinations of genes, either individually or, like I say, the original dominant oncogene, or a combination of these genes, nobody's ever demonstrated that they cause cancer, that they turn a normal diploid cell into a cancer cell. It just doesn't exist. It's purely a hypothetical. It's a belief, basically. People don't have, for some time now, for some decades, have not had an alternative. Scientists will cling to a bad theory in the absence of any superior theory, and that's what's happened. The antibody theory now is superior, but there's too many decades now, too many billions of dollars, and too many reputations that have been built and at stake on this gene mutation thing for people to all of a sudden cling to the aneuploidy theory of cancer,
right.
Which
well,
is old, by the way. It's about 100 years old.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that in just a minute. So just one more question regarding mutations. So it seems like to me that a simple experiment would be to take some normal human cells, cause some mutations, and see if cancer formed. And you're saying those experiments have not succeeded or not have been...
They've been attempted. And people have put these cancer genes into cells using all the fancy genetic engineering techniques, they've never, ever succeeded. Whenever they get a cancer cell, they always wind up causing aneuploidy, and the aneuploidy, is really what's driving this thing, not the genes themselves. And they have these animal models where they put these oncogenes in these animals, you know, in every cell in these animals' body, and they're rodents generally. And when they do get cancer, they're always these clonal cancers, and they're localized, just like any other cancer. So there has to be something else going on other than the fact that those cancer genes are in the animals, or else they wouldn't have been born in the first place. And when they are born with these cancer genes, then they should have cancer all the time all over their bodies, and they don't.
Right.
So there's a conceptual problem even with the oncogene theory and these animal models. Are we still there?
Yes, I'm really sorry about that. I just disappeared and nobody knows what happened to my phone. I was just about to ask you about aneuploidy, but I don't know. We had talked a little bit about the mutations in a test tube and their inability to cause cancer. So now let's talk about aneuploidy. Obviously, the word is related to diploid. So can you explain what aneuploidy is and then how it's related to cancer?
Okay. Ploidy is just the number and balance of chromosomes. Like euploid means the normal ploidy, and euploidy or normal ploidy in human cells are exactly two copies each of 23 distinct chromosomes for a total of 46 chromosomes. Aneuploidy means against or the not normal ploidy. Aneuploidy means anything other than the exact two copies of each of 23 chromosomes in humans. So Down syndrome is aneuploid because there's three copies of chromosome 21. Cancer cells typically have between 60 and 90 chromosomes, about 50 to 60% more chromosomes in the cancer cell than you would have in the normal cell of the same human being.
Now, are these normal chromosomes, and are they like an entire duplicate set, or are there just some chromosomes that get duplicated more than others?
There's a mix. The thing, a normal cell has exactly, like I say, a photocopy of the right number of chromosomes every time the cell divides. Cancer cells, whenever they divide, they're unstable. They always generate a different number and combination of chromosomes. Sometimes it's just scrambling them around. In other words, you might have two copies of one chromosome, three copies of another one, one copy of yet another one, or four copies or whatever. And you would also have these what are called marker chromosomes. When the chromosomes break apart and they fuse back together, making longer or smaller chromosomes, bits and pieces of chromosomes, these are called marker chromosomes. And it's like these cancer cells, these aneuploid cancer cells, all cancers that have been documented to date, there's no exception. I'm talking about confirmed cancer, confirmed with the ploidy, are all aneuploid. And no two of them are alike. They're like snowflakes. You know one when you see it, but you never see the same one twice.
So you're saying within the same tumor, every cell has a different ploidy.
Right. They're all different. The ploidy, you can have, for example, a diploid cell that is not truly diploid. In other words, it'll have the 46 chromosomes, but it might have only one copy of one of the chromosomes and three copies of another chromosome. Now, it's unbalanced, but it's still diploid in that sense. And the proper designation of that is a pseudo-diploid.
Because it's not a euploid cell because it's not really a true set.
Right, it's a pseudo-diploid or a false diploid. In fact, it is aneuploid because it's unbalanced. Now, you can have a completely balanced set that is not 46. For example, there are babies that have been born with exactly three copies of every chromosome, and even rarer, babies born with four copies of every chromosome. These are extremely rare situations, and the poor little kids don't live very long, but they have arms and legs and ears and noses and eyes and things like that, although they do look a little bit odd, like aliens or something from outer space. But you never, ever see babies born with the kind of aneuploidy that you see in cancer cells. Like, as I said before, about the only ones that are survivable are Down syndrome, where you have three copies of the smallest chromosome, and they don't do well.
And aneuploid cells have a different metabolism. So how does that work? Like, why would that be?
It's the best example I could... Unless people went to Georgia Tech like I did and know what Ramblin' Wrecks are in the Ramblin' Wreck Parade, that's the best analogy I've ever come up with cancer cells. In essence, what you have is when you unbalance the cell, and the machinery of the cell are all the proteins that the genes code for and all the metabolism and everything that goes on, when you unbalance all of those molecules and those enzymes in the cell, you unbalance all the biochemistry in the cell, the metabolism of the cell. And and that's one reason why most of these aneuploid cells don't do well. They don't divide. In fact, most of them die. It's because they're so messed up. But occasionally, one will be able to, one or a few of them will be able to survive. They'd be like the Ramblin' Wreck Parade, that they're junkers and they hardly ever work well, but they still can make it around the course of the parade. Those are cancer cells. And this goes contrary to what most people think about cancer cells. They think of cancer cells as supercells. that divide rapidly, they're fast-growing. No, cancer cells are damaged cells. They almost always die. There's nothing a cancer cell can do that a normal cell cannot do better, even invasiveness. Macrophages are far more invasive than cancer cells. The difference is the cancer cells are out of whack, and they cause a great deal of damage, where the macrophages go right through, and they don't cause any damage. It's the imbalance in chromosomes is the key to cancer, is the key to what's going on in cancer. And
So we have a cell that's become aneuploid, and for whatever reason, it's able to survive and to divide, but it's going to divide into two daughter cells that are probably both different in aneuploidy. What's the chances that those will survive? How could a cancer exist if most aneuploid cells are unstable enough to die?
Well, fortunately, they almost always die. What happens is, and the cancer, at least in the wild, it's a rare thing, by the way. You don't see much cancer in the wild, like talking about animals. You don't see it in plants and very rarely in wild animals. You see cancer in domestic animals like birds and dogs and things like that. They experience the same environment as humans. Cancer has grown explosively in the past two centuries, and accelerating even in the 20th century and into this century. It's exploding in the human population. Cancer is almost all caused by exogenous, meaning environmental influences, either radiation, chemicals, that sort of thing, and cigarette smoking and things like that. When you have large doses, repeated doses, chronic doses of carcinogens, then you're playing around with a cellular lottery. You're buying more and more lottery tickets, and you keep getting these carcinogens. It's screwing up the chromosomes, and most of them die, fortunately. You know, but some don't. Sometimes they win in a bad sense, the molecular or cellular lottery, and some of them don't. They catch on,
and then they have the ability to reproduce. I mean, they must have the ability to reproduce with enough accuracy that the daughter cells are viable. Because I mean, a cancer can only grow if it has the ability to reproduce the cells within it, right?
That's right, and that's this. People may have heard of the expression "clonal cancer." The cancer is clonal. You have this population. You generally what happens is you generate a population of aneuploid cells. No two of these are alike, and they're just dying off in droves. But they can divide. You know, if you keep them going, it's like a low little fire going, and at some point, just by sheer chance, it's like an evolutionary process, and truly it is evolutionary process, that they will hit upon a certain combination or minimal combination of chromosomes that will survive. And one of the tricks that these cancer cells have devised, in fact, I'm convinced that it's absolutely essential for carcinogenesis, that the chromosome number must double at some point. And this is not a controversial statement. It's widely accepted, even among mainstream cancer researchers, that the chromosome of the 46 chromosomes, and they get what near diploid aneuploidy, 47 chromosomes, 44, 45, 48, something like that. They cannot progress linearly up to the massive levels of aneuploidy that are seen in invasive malignant cancer. They die out before they get there. What happens is they're so screwed up with their imbalance in chromosomes that during the process of mitosis, at one point, instead of dividing the cells, they stop. Remember, I said during mitosis, you always double your chromosomes,
and then they divide.
Well, many of them, even the aneuploid cells, will double the chromosomes that they have, but then they won't divide. And they sit there with double those chromosomes, and they just sit there and don't do anything. Then they may go through a second round of division and doubling of chromosomes. Now they have four times the amount of chromosomes or DNA of a normal cell. And if they do divide, now they have plenty of chromosomes that they can afford to lose without losing viability. That's called tetraploidization. So you wind up, your cell will have around 90-something chromosomes. It's very unstable. It loses chromosomes down to around, 60 to 90 chromosomes, somewhere in there. typically what we call a DNA index of around 1.7. In other words, 70% roughly spread out. It's not very precise. Chromosomes over a normal cell. Now, these cells contain sufficient DNA, sufficient chromosomes, that they can still maintain metabolism, viability, even though they're damaged cells still. They can lose chromosomes, but they have enough to get the job done.
So there are some chromosomes that are necessary for the viability of the cell?
Chromosomes are necessary. But you don't have to have two copies of every chromosome. There's not an example. Peter Duisberg and I have talked about this, and other people have mentioned it. We do not know of a cancer cell that has a complete loss of any one chromosome, except the Y chromosome is about the only one you can lose, and it doesn't matter.
Is that the male chromosome? I always get X and Y mixed up.
That's the male chromosome, right.
But I'm not sure that's saying anything positive about men. But
well, males are actually slightly aneuploid compared to women, so maybe that explains the weirdness of males compared to women. Slightly aneuploid.
That seems like an important point. So that what you're saying is that, you know, we have 23 chromosomes, and for a viable cell, you must have one copy of all of those. Cancerous cells may have 3, 4, 5 copies of some of them, but they will have at least one copy, you think, of all of them. That if they lose a particular chromosome entirely, that cell will probably die.
That seems to be the case, because we do not know of an example of a cancer cell or an aneuploid cell that does not have at least one copy of every chromosome.
Okay, that is a very interesting point and something I did not know. Let's talk about the history of aneuploidy for a little bit, because it's definitely not a new idea. It goes back to the 1800s.
That's right. David von Hanselmann, he was really one of the first guys to observe what we call chromosomes and DNA. They call chromatin in those days. And he observed this aneuploidy, or excess or imbalance of chromosomes, in every one of the epithelial cancers that he looked at under the microscope. And in fact, he was one of the first people to speculate that it was this imbalance in chromosomes, or chromatin in his day was called, was responsible for cancer. And his colleague, Theodore Boveri, had actually written a monograph in 1914. He'd done some experiments in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and he eventually wound up writing a monograph in 1914, the year World War II started.
World War I, yeah.
Where he spelled out his theory. He didn't call it aneuploidy theory. It was chromosomal theory of cancer, where he specifically said that it was not the it wasn't important how the aneuploidy is produced in a cell. I'm paraphrasing. He said it's the aneuploidy itself. It's the peculiar combination of chromosomes that causes the cancer, and that these things are unstable and that they will change over time, and that they were responsible for all the properties of cancer. He had basically, Theodore Boveri, had cancer figured out, solved, back in 1914. But Peter Duisberg, I, and a number of other people around the world, and that number is growing, by the way, actually quite fast. All we've really done is confirm his original theory and extended it with lots of other theoretical adaptations, additions, and experimentally. The evidence is really, aneuploidy theory is right. It's not wise for a scientist to be certain of anything. And I, as a scientist, know this because we're almost always wrong. But I'm certain of two things as a scientist. I'm certain that, as you mentioned about AIDS is not contagious, sexually transmitted, or caused by HIV. I'm certain of that.
Right.
The other thing that I'm certain of as a scientist, and certain enough and for some time, is that cancer is a consequence of chromosomal imbalance or aneuploidy, and it's the progression of this chromosomal imbalance is in fact carcinogenesis in the progression of cancer. And
okay, one more question
about
history. So back in 1913, 1914, what was the concept of chromosomes? Because this is before Watson and Crick and DNA and all that stuff. Like, what did Boveri think that the chromosomes were in the body, in the cell?
That, Right. Well, he thought it was the, I don't know what words he used, chromatin is what they, it was in the nucleus, and they knew what it was, and they could see chromosomes and everything. And I think Stanton and Boveri were two of the first people to suggest that, that this chromatin, which we call chromosomes now, was the genetic material of cells. In fact, Boveri even proved it in his experimental work on sea urchin eggs. Other people have confirmed it or proved it also repeatedly over the years that this is true. But he was one of the first ones to do it, was Boveri, even though Boveri and Stanton were the two people back in those early days to propose that this chromatin or chromosomal material was the material, the hereditary material of a cell.
Right, right. So they did have some idea of the importance of chromosomes.
Boveri actually demonstrated experimentally that each of the chromosomes are unique, have unique properties. You know, there's 23 different for human chromosomes, the different ones in the sea urchin, but that they all have different properties. And when you mix these different properties up, you get different phenotypes, for example. And some of his experiments with sea urchin eggs, when he could experimentally induce aneuploidy in the sea urchin eggs, and he noticed that in the process of development, some of them, as they developed, he actually called them tumors because of the way they looked.
Okay.
And this is what led him to his theory, his chromosomal theory of cancer back in 1914. Unfortunately, he died within a year, and it was also World War I, and his theory just was sitting there for a long, long time.
Nobody followed it up.
The world was not thinking about that at the time.
Just before World War I and became dogmas. Maybe by the time of the end of World War I, people thought, well, it's been 10 years since that was decided, so it must be right, even though maybe nothing had been done during World War I because of the disturbance of the world. The world was going aneuploid, I guess. Let's talk about what cause. Okay, so if the mutation theory is correct, chemicals that cause mutations should cause cancer, and if the aneuploidy theory is correct, chemicals or other environmental things that cause aneuploidy should cause cancer, and presumably not everything that causes mutations causes aneuploidy and vice versa.
Yeah, I can tell you what is known. About half of the carcinogens that have been tested do not cause gene mutations. And in fact, you know, the point mutations that that people are talking about, like you change a G for a T or something like that,
right,
about half of them. And those turn out to be the most potent carcinogens of all, the ones that do not cause gene mutations. But all of the carcinogens that have been tested, all of them cause aneuploidy.
And does this include, this must include radiation as well as chemicals?
Radiation does, asbestos does, coal tars do, everything that has been tested. And in fact, in my view, most of the carcinogens, the real carcinogens are probably mechanical and physical carcinogens. For example, like the coal tars and asbestos, they're mechanical carcinogens. They get inside the cell. And they're chemically inert. They don't do anything.
Right.
But they're very sticky, and they asbestos fibers, they know exactly the dimensions, the physical dimensions of those fibers that are carcinogenic. They're little needles that get in there, and they stick in the spindle apparatus. The spindle apparatus are these sort of muscular machine proteins that physically pull the chromosomes apart during cell division.
So the asbestos fibers are that fine. They can just get inside the cell.
In fact, you can see them really easily with electron microscope. You can see them actually stuck in spindle fibers. And they prevent the spindles from pulling the chromosomes apart, and they lead to an imbalance in the separation of chromosomes during cell division and cause aneuploidy, and then it progresses from that point on. The same thing with coal tars. Radiation, for example, you can take single photons of radiation. A lot of people think that you have to mutate the genes so they can, you know, put the the radiation right in the nucleus and do something to the DNA. But it's experimentally been demonstrated now for many years, probably a decade at least, 15 years or so, that you can actually do the same experiment and just put the single photons or particles, like alpha particles, through the cytoplasm and cause aneuploidy and cause transformation of those cells, which will eventually wind up being cancer cells.
Well, I'm not sure I understood that. You're saying that you can put radiation through the cytoplasm, not through the nucleus, and cause aneuploidy?
Yes,
why would that be?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been done on a variety of ways. Even single photons at a time or single particles at a time, people can do that.
But why would a disturbance of the cytoplasm cause aneuploidy?
Because that's where the machinery of cell division is located.
Okay, so I always thought it was necessary for the radiation to actually hit the chromosome, but you're saying that if you mess up the mechanism for division, that's just as bad or maybe even worse.
Yes, it is. It's as bad or even worse. Anything that can generate, just as exactly as Theodore Boveri said, anything that can lead to an imbalance of chromosomes, it doesn't matter what that thing is or how it does it. As long as it leads to an imbalance in chromosomes, that will lead to cancer if the cells survive.
This seems to be a situation where the information, if the aneuploid theory is right, that it has tremendous potentially positive consequences. Because, first of all, we could identify the compounds that are most likely to cause cancer and make sure that those are banned or that we're protected from exposure to them as best as is possible. Secondly, we could probably see these changes earlier, so there would be better diagnostic techniques. And, maybe there would be, ideas for therapy, although it's hard for me to see how an aneuploid cell can be helped in any way through adding more chemicals. But is that what you think, too?
You're absolutely right. And the interesting thing is that most of the industrialized countries in the world have for some years had it as a policy, just empirically derived, but they realize how important it is, that they actually test chemicals and physical materials for the ability to cause aneuploidy. And if they do cause aneuploidy, then they label them as carcinogens. The United States does not, although they're in the process of trying to equalize this with the other countries around the world. And now when I say that, it was as of the time that I wrote my book and it got published in 2012. I actually have that in the book about that. So most countries, industrialized countries, look for substances, their ability to cause aneuploidy, to determine whether or not they should be labeled as carcinogens. That's important. The other thing is what were the other things that you mentioned? One about the diagnostics, absolutely. Again, empirically, because the chromosomes and the aneuploidy is so prevalent that there has been, even Abbott Laboratories in the United States has what, I forget the name of their test, they have a particular test for bladder cancer. That looks for aneuploidy of three chromosomes and part of another chromosome. And people look at it under a microscope and look for this. And they think it's only valid because the FDA has only approved it for bladder cancer. But that test could be used to detect and follow any cancer whatever, because there's always those chromosomes in a population of aneuploid cells, cancer cells, do always find aneuploidy of them. They have a test already available that would work universally anywhere in the world on any cancer. But because they don't know what they have, they don't understand the aneuploidy theory, they're limiting it to just bladder cancer. Germany, they measure aneuploidy in a slightly different way. Rather than looking at individual chromosomes, they look at the DNA mass of the nucleus of a cell as a whole.
Okay.
And DNA content by looking at just the DNA, staining all the DNA. Mm-hmm. It was the same color. And because of good old German precision, they're able to be able to measure the difference all the way down to a difference of a single chromosome just by the color intensity of the nucleus. And it works for any cancer, and they're developing it for more and more cancers in Germany. So that's already there. It just needs to be more extensively used and recognized and understood. Now, the therapy thing is very interesting because the aneuploidy theory teaches a lot about cancer. That's the most important thing. You really understand what cancer is and its weaknesses. Cancer is is very lame material, which a lot of people don't know. A lethal tumor, the majority, huge amounts of cells in a lethal tumor are dying spontaneously all the time because those cells are damaged cells. But there's just like it's got a critical mass where they don't all die and they just keep on going. Because all those cells are different, they all have a different metabolic makeup that they're intrinsic. Step back just a moment. Because these cells, they're individual, they all have their own genomes. They're like a single cell organism, like bacteria or yeast. Mm-hmm. And there will always be a subpopulation of cells that will have a metabolism that is different than the ones that are being targeted by any single toxic drug or any combination of drugs that cell will be resistant to. So in principle, it's not possible to ever develop a chemotherapy cytotoxic drug for cancer that will not have immediate resistance built into it. There's no way you can get around drug resistance in aneuploid cells. It's not possible with toxic drugs. But on the other hand, the aneuploidy theory teaches that since these things, it's also obvious, pathologists have known this at least as far back as Peyton Rouse's day, that these cancer cells or wimpy cells are dying all the time, it should be possible to assist these cancer cells to die spontaneously even faster than they do normally without using poisons.
A relatively innocuous change in the environment, like heat or something, could have much more damaging impacts on cancer cells than on regular cells.
In fact, high spiking fever is the leading preceding event to documented spontaneous remission of cancer around the world over the past 100 years. High spiking fever from infectious diseases or iatrogenic infections in the hospital, for example.
Right.
And hot flashes have been documented to be preventive of breast cancer in the past few years. Women that have hot flashes and they're drenching night sweats have the least likelihood of developing breast cancer. Go ahead.
Has anybody looked at association between cancer and people who suppress fevers on a regular basis? Like if I get a fever, I just go to bed for a day or whatever is necessary, drink lots of fluids. I never take anything, but there's lots of people that the slightest increase in temperature, they're taking a drug to suppress the fever. Has anybody looked at whether those people have an increased risk of cancer?
If they have, I don't know about that. But the other end, I do know. I hear a loud phone.
Don't worry about it. I will turn off my phone ringer. I want to finish this conversation. We only have another 15 minutes before we're over. But that would be something interesting to look at.
I tell you what is important. What is known, though, this Collie, you may have not heard of him. He was the first half of the 20th century. I can't remember his first name, but he developed a thing called what we now call Collie's toxin. Have you heard of that?
Mm-hmm.
Where he induced fever by causing infections, and to this day he has the best success rate of remission, either partial remission, sometimes it would come back, the cancers would come back, and total remission of anything that's ever been done so far. Unfortunately, and it's known all over the world, and they still use the Collie's toxins outside the USA, in Europe, for example, in Mexico, but not in USA. The Collie's toxins lost favor in the United States for lots of reasons. High technology took over, and you know, molecular biology and all that sort of thing. This induction of fever was not considered important, and to this day, fever is not considered an important thing in immunology. And they tried to write off cholestoxin as just a generalized immune, specific immune response, and your immune system is what really wiped out the cancer. That's not true at all. The immune system does not recognize cancer and has no effect on it at all. It was the high spiking fever that had the effect.
They've tried a lot of things with the immune system. Isn't that what the interleukin drugs are supposed to do? But it seems like they've just produced really toxic drugs that, like all chemotherapy, are very ineffective and very toxic and very profitable, which I'm sure has nothing to do with it. I want to address two more things before we're done.
Okay.
We're starting to run out of time. The first is claims of diploid cancer. Now, I've seen some, and at the last minute I sent you some, but I think you're pretty familiar with the literature on diploid cancer. Is there a diploid cancer? What are they talking about when they claim it?
A diploid cancer, in essence, what they're claiming is euploid, in the sense that there's a cancer malignancy, a malignant cancer, just cancer, what people call cancer, think of as cancer, that has the exact right number of chromosomes. That's the claim when they claim a diploid cancer. Peter and I have looked for confirmed examples of diploid cancer or euploid cancer, and there's none anywhere in the literature. There's tons of claims of diploid cancer, which are erroneous in the sense that in the literal sense of the word, they weren't done properly. The techniques weren't done properly. They would culture, for example, they'd culture cells. There weren't enough cells to be able to look at metaphases on a metaphase analysis. So they put them in cell cultures from a tumor. Atkin and Baker had done a comparison where they looked at the same tumor cells, that they did a chromosomal analysis immediately, or they cultured the cells. Something like 80% of the times when they cultured the cells, just after just a few cell divisions, the cultured cells would only be, would all the aneuploid cells would be gone and only diploid cells were left. And those were the normal diploid cells that accompanied the cancer cells.
Okay, let me go over this again. So if a tumor has within it some diploid cells that maybe aren't cancerous, but they're in the tumor because it's incorporated other materials, if you put a sample of cancer cells in cell culture, the aneuploid cells, so you've changed the environment, might all die because they're not as strong, and you would be left with just diploid cells.
Right, and that's led to countless claims and confusion that there is such a thing as diploid cells, and then diploid cancers. And then there's a technique called flow cytometry that was popular in the 1970s. It was like microarrays are these days. Everybody has to have one. They're very expensive and fancy technology. Back in the 70s, it was flow cytometry. Unfortunately, it was very technically demanding equipment. Everybody had one. They were using it for everything. And they were making all these claims, and there was contradictory information all over the place. There was conceptual problems with flow cytometry detecting aneuploid or diploid cancers. They're slowly being improved to this day, but other technology like individual cell analysis, image analysis, and FISH and so on, the flow cytometry can tell really frank, if you got a really good, pure, clean tumor, you can really see the aneuploid samples in it. But you had to have peaks. Remember these aneuploid cells, the cancer cells, they cells all over the place. And they frequently don't give you, they give you a mushy, spread out distribution of aneuploid cells instead of a nice, sharp, pristine peak like the diploid cells get. And yet, by definition, they could only call a peak aneuploid if it had a peak, you know, even if it was a mushy old area way away from a peak, if it wasn't a definable peak, they would ignore it and not call it. And then there would have this broad base of cells covered under the diploid peak that had pseudo-diploid cells under it, these early stages, for example, like the leukemias.
I saw one paper that talked about, you know, that there was a peak of what they called heteroploid, which is probably tetraploid, and then there was aneuploid, which was above tetraploid. But they also had a peak diploid. But I was wondering, you know, was that exactly diploid, or was that diploid plus or minus a few chromosomes? And you're saying it probably was plus or minus. Plus,
you don't know. You don't know until you look at until you look at the cells themselves, and not a population like that. You have to go in, and you have to understand the techniques that you're working with, their limitations. And when you go in and you look at using image analysis, those things, whenever there were claimed diploid cancers using flow cytometry, when you looked at the same sample before you did flow, once you use flow, those cells are gone. You can never recover them and analyze them again. So you have to divide them in portions when you start and do the analysis. They're always aneuploid. There's no exception. Whenever the claims that I've seen, or Peter and anybody have ever seen, we've asked for it. In fact, Peter and I are the only people that I know of that really put our necks out on the block. We say, listen, if you can find a confirmed diploid cancer, meaning euploid cancer, then that's probably the death knell of the aneuploidy theory. You know, we're saying that flat out, and nobody's ever, people have tried, but they've never succeeded.
Yes. So finally, in the last couple of minutes, what is the acceptance? You alluded to the fact that this theory was gaining a bit more acceptance in the mainstream cancer community, which is very resistant to change. I think that's a fair comment. So there are people outside of yourself and Peter who are interested in this, and it's growing?
Oh, yeah. Mostly the Europeans and the Asians and the Americans, but because of our AIDS work, we're sort of anathema, you know. Mm-hmm. They don't cite our papers much in the United States, but they're starting to work on cancer, on aneuploidy, without citing our work, and they're rediscovering the wheel, the stuff that we've already published, and even the stuff that Boveri's published. We're very excited by the fact that there's more work on it. And we are getting cited more and more, but not by the Americans so much. And we've had two aneuploidy conferences, 2004, 2008, Peter and I have held here in Oakland, very successful. And we're planning another one for next year.
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, it's a sad commentary on science. I presume that a lot of these scientists are aware of your work on aneuploidy, and they've read it, but they will not cite it because that could be dangerous to their career to be associated with a heretic.
That's true. Peter and I, whenever we find them, especially some that we know or some that we don't know, we point out to them, you know, we're very nice in our emails to them corresponding with these folks, and we say, well, maybe you should be aware of these other papers, you know, that preceded theirs, that we've basically already done what they did. And they said, they sent us back an email, say, yes, we do know about it. And they say, but, you know, there's only so much room for citation in a paper or whatever
they
can come up with, you know.
Apart from sheer cowardice. They don't like to admit to that. Yes, I would actually love to talk about the case where somebody working for the U.S. government attended one of your aneuploidy conferences under a fake name, and later we discovered he was trying to spy on AIDS dissidents, AIDS rethinkers, but he must have been going to your conference to try to find out something damaging about you or Peter related to aneuploidy or cause trouble or something.
Kalishman.
Yes, under the name Joseph Newton.
Yeah, that was as if we cared. I mean, it was wide open things.
I mean, a scientific conference should be pretty open, so it's really strange to go under a fake name, but I'm sure there's more behind that story. But I would just to thank you for giving a really good summary of the aneuploidy theory of cancer. Appreciate your patience with me trying to go through this very slowly so I could get my head around it. And I really appreciate some of the things you brought out that I hadn't really thought of before but seem to be very important. And all I can hope, as you do, is that people who have any kind of influence on cancer research will think about this, whether they are raising money for cancer or they're involved as a cancer scientist or they're talking to a cancer doctor, that they will mention this and encourage doctors and researchers to become more knowledgeable about it.
It's on my website, davidrasnick.com.
And your book. Tell me about your book, the name of your book before we go.
Yeah, my book is The Chromosomal Imbalance Theory of AIDS, The Autocatalyzed Progression of Aneuploidy is Carcinogenesis. It was published in 2012. It's written for cancer researchers, so it's somewhat technical. But you can go to my website, davidrasnick.com. Right on the homepage, there's a picture of the cover. There's a table of contents, a preface, an index that you can download and look at. And there's also at the top, you can click on the little thing that says cancer, and it opens up a page full of all kinds of aneuploidy stuff. It's got a picture of Bovary, Hanselman, chromosomes, claims of diploid cancer, HPV, all that nonsense, cervical
right.
cancer. There's a wealth of stuff on there.
Yeah, I'm sure there's other things that I should have you back to talk about. I read you have a paper, Aneuploidy Theory in Plain Language, which is right at the top, and I think people
right.
should start there, especially if they're a little shaky on you know, cell chromosomal biology.
Right.
It really goes through it very patiently, and I think that's a really good place to start. But definitely there's a lot more information there. And then there's your book for people who really want to get into this and understand it in much greater detail.
Yeah.
So thank you very much. I think we have to go. It's 1 minute before
yep.
the hour. But I really appreciate you joining me today, David.
Well, it was fun. I was glad to do it.
Yes. Thank you so much.
All righty. Thank you. Bye.